Moving right along, we have one more speaker before our next break. And, you know, it's not every day that you have the privilege to hear from two lawyers at an Ag Water conference. But Tiffany's going to share with us some interesting insight into various lawsuits that potentially impact or will be of interest to those of you in the ag sector. She hails from eastern New Mexico, has degrees from New Mexico as well as Oklahoma, but now works with Texas A&M AgriLife, and I will turn it over to her to keep us on schedule.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I don't know what you all did to get a politician, a weatherman, and a lawyer right after lunch, but congratulations. We're going to talk today about a few water law issues that I think are really interesting. I've recognized a couple people in the audience that were at my program last night, so this is 2 days in a row. I see you. Yes, you're welcome. Okay, so let's get started. And just so there is some breaking water law news. If you've not been on your phone because you've been paying attention today, the Trump administration has rolled out its new final definition of waters of the United States. That happened this morning. That's not in my slides because I didn't know. But so if you've been following the waters of the United States battle that's been going on, the new rule is out today. I'd sure recommend that you check that out, and then I would buckle up because I assume that we're going to see a flood of lawsuits from the other side now talking about how this definition now is too narrow, and we'll probably be here in 10 years still bickering about that. But that's the breaking news that I have to share today. So here's sort of what I'm going to do to cover today. I'm going to do kind of just a brief overview of Texas water law. I've done that presentation here before in more depth, and many of you probably are as familiar or more so than I am with the topic of Texas water law. But we'll do just a brief overview, and then I've got three topics that I want to discuss. The first one I think is a really interesting issue involving some disputes that have been going on as far as when you've got two states that border each other that each have different water laws. And you've got arguments that affect the water law of both states on the border. Interesting issue from southern New Mexico and the Texas border we will look at. No lawsuits filed on that yet, but I certainly think there's the potential for that to be a huge issue. The next thing that we will look at is a case from down around Bryan College Station called the Strata case. And I think that that is going to raise some really interesting issues about right to produce groundwater and how much groundwater potentially you have the right to produce based on the size of the tract of land that you own. And then we'll wrap up and look at a federal issue, which is called groundwater as a conduit. That's a case that's currently pending, actually, before the United States Supreme Court. We were expecting a ruling on that case here before the break for the court in June. And so that's kind of what we're going to cover and go over today. So the first thing that we'll talk about, Texas water law, everyone probably knows, right, that the type of law that applies really depends on the category of water that we're discussing. Right? And so we kind of put water into basically three categories in Texas. The first one's groundwater, right? And that's that water that's percolating in an aquifer. So the Ogallala Aquifer, the Edwards Aquifer, that's the groundwater. Okay? Then we've also got surface water, okay? And that's going to be defined as water in a defined water course. And that's a little bit trickier than maybe it needs to be, so we'll talk about that briefly. And then we have diffuse surface water. And what that is water that's kind of like sheet flow or like storm runoff before it gets into a defined water course. The reason that these differences really matter is because depending on the category of water you have, a different type of law applies. And that's different than a lot of other Western states that kind of have one applicable category for, or one applicable type of law for all types of water. So in Texas, who owns the groundwater? Landowner, right? The landowner owns the water beneath your property. More specific, it's the surface owner. So if you've got severed minerals, the groundwater goes with the surface, okay? The one little asterisk I always give here is the one way that could be different is if those groundwater rights were severed off separately, right? So just as you might be able to sever off your mineral rights and have one surface owner and one mineral owner, you also could sever off your groundwater rights and have a separate groundwater owner. In that scenario, it would be different than the surface owner, but otherwise, surface owner owns the groundwater. It's governed by what we call the rule of capture. Some courts you'll see also call this the absolute dominion rule, right? Which means we have an ownership interest in the water beneath our property. And we're subject to a couple of limitations or regulations. The first sets of those are called common law limitations. Those I like to refer to as the don't be a jerk rules. So those are things like, you have the right to pump the water beneath your land, but you can't do that if your sole purpose for doing so is to make your neighbor's well go dry. Don't be a jerk, right? You can't pump water if you're only going to use it and for waste. If you're going to like let it run down the bar ditch and just waste it, can't do that. Those rarely come up in the cases. The other kind of regulatory control that we have over groundwater in Texas is the local groundwater conservation districts. And again, I know some of this is probably really basic for you all, but just in case, I don't know the knowledge level of everyone in the room. In Texas, we do not have a statewide body that governs groundwater. Instead, the legislature decided we'd be better off with allowing local control. And so instead, what we have is about 100 groundwater conservation districts scattered throughout the state. And those districts manage the water within their jurisdiction. If you want more information about groundwater conservation districts, I just did a great podcast episode on my show with Victoria from the High Plains Groundwater District. She's here kind of lurking in the back. But if you want more information on groundwater conservation districts, that episode's available. I'll give you that information in a few minutes. And so that sort of is how the regulatory scheme goes. If you're in an area with a groundwater conservation district, here I think is the map. So if you're in an area that's colored on the map, right, you are subject to the rules of that groundwater conservation district. As you'll see, there's 100 different districts and 100 different rules. And so that can be a little bit complicated to figure out exactly what rules apply to you. All right. If you are in a white area on the map and there is no groundwater conservation district, that's the Wild West. Okay. Anybody can drill any well they want, pump as much as they want. There's no regulatory oversight. And so that's sort of how the system is set up at this point, at least. Okay, so when we talk about that surface water, and again, that's going to be water in a defined water course, right? So if we're talking about creeks, rivers, lakes, that's going to be that's going to be surface water here in Texas. Who owns the surface water? State, right? The state of Texas owns that water, or they at least hold it in trust for the public. And where I think that this gets tricky, right, is that when we talk about water in a defined water course, if we're talking about, you know, the Brazos River, we all understand that's state-owned surface water. But what if we're talking about a little creek that just has a little bit of a V that flows across your private property? Probably that's state-owned surface water, too. And that's because of the very broad definition they take of the term defined water course. So if you look at the law, something is in a defined water course, and therefore state-owned water, if it meets a three-part test. The first part requirement is it has to have a bed and bank, it has to have a current, and it has to have a permanent source of water. That seems pretty easy. Except that we have court cases that say things like, it has to have a defined bed and bank, but you don't have to actually be able to see it. Right? Then it says, has to have a permanent source, but it's okay if that source is just when it rains 5 times a year. And it has to have a current, but it's okay if the current only flows when there's water in the creek. So it's pretty broad, is what I'm telling you, right? And if you're dealing with that state-owned surface water, then that's governed by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and you have to get a permit from the TCEQ, generally, to use that water. All right, so that's how that system works. Very different from our regulation for groundwater. The TCEQ permit process is governed by what we call prior appropriation. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. But prior appropriation pretty much means first come, first served. Right? So if I have, let's say that I went and got a permit to irrigate my corn out of the Brazos River in the year 2000. But David Gibson has a permit from, you know, the Stone Ages, because he's been around forever. So if we have a shortage of water, if we're in a drought, David's going to get every drop of water that he's entitled to before I get a drop of mine. And that's because he's a senior appropriator to me. So that's kind of how that system works. There are a couple of exceptions to that permitting requirement. The one that agriculture probably cares the most about is You can divert water for domestic or livestock use if you're getting that out of a non-navigable stream. So if we've got just a little creek that flows across our property and we want to divert it to water our cows, good to go. You don't have to get a permit from the TCEQ. If, however, the stream that runs across our property is a navigable stream, then we actually do have to get a permit even to divert that water for domestic or livestock use. And then lastly, what's the diffuse surface water? Again, that's that sheet flow runoff before it gets into any sort of water course. In Texas, that can be used by the landowner upon whose property it is found. And so a landowner has the right to capture the rainwater, right? If you want to go dig a big hole and wait for it to rain, that's your water. You can use it however you want, no permits. Okay, that's different than some other states, right? Colorado is a state, I think, that's much stricter about the use of the rainwater, etc. The one rule that we have on that is you can't divert that in a way that will flood your neighbor. I always tell people that's not an issue in the panhandle, right? None of us are trying to push water on someone else. We're happy to collect it all ourselves. So that's not a question I get much of in this part of the world. Last kind of basic point, and then we'll get into our cases I want to mention here, is the idea of a navigable stream. Okay, and the idea of a navigable stream really matters for two reasons. The first, remember, is I said if you want to use that state-owned surface water for domestic or livestock use, you can do that without a permit if it's on a non-navigable stream. But if it's on a navigable stream, you got to get a permit. Okay, so that's number one. The second reason why it matters is if you have a navigable stream that's on your private property, under the law in Texas, that stream bed is owned by the state, and it's open to the public. Which means, right, let's say that we have some hippie kayaker from Austin who wants to kayak across my creek in Carson County. If it's a navigable stream, he has the right to do that. He's not trespassing. Now, he has to stay in the creek, right? He can't get up out of there. He has to stay in the stream bed. And he can't cross my private property to get to the creek. Okay? But if it's navigable, he has the right to be there. Okay? Now let's look at the definition of navigability. This is going to surprise you. There's two definitions under the law. A stream only needs to meet one of these to be navigable. The first one's called navigable in fact, which means if it can be used in trade or commerce, it's navigable. So if you can put a boat in the stream, it's navigable. Courts have said if you can float logs down it, it's navigable. Okay, that's our first test. Our second test says, if the stream bed, not where the water is, the stream bed maintains an average width of 30 feet, it's navigable. Even if there's no water in it. So don't you think, right? I'm thinking about my part of the world where we live. There are some big old dry creek beds, right, that are much wider than 30 feet that have no water, that technically under Texas law would be a navigable stream, and the kayaker can't really kayak down them, but I guess he could carry his kayak and walk down them because they're open to the public. Okay, that's an issue that I get lots of questions on from Central Texas. People are usually mad about it, but just something to be aware of, kind of that's how the law works on that. So with that, let's talk about a couple of cases. Like I mentioned, I call this the state line water clash. There has not been any litigation filed about this, at least as of yet, but I think it's a really interesting issue. And so everybody knows, right, southeastern New Mexico down in Lee County is big-time oil and gas. We produce a lot of oil and gas there in New Mexico. New Mexico water law, groundwater and surface water, is governed by prior appropriation, right? Remember, that's that first come, first serve. You got to go get a permit from the state of New Mexico. It's the state engineer if you want to produce groundwater. Okay, well, New Mexico is right next to Texas, as we know, and Lee County borders right up to Loving County, right across the border. And in Loving County, because that's in Texas, who owns that groundwater? The landowner, right? And so the landowner can pump as much as they want, don't have to get a permit, and in fact, there's also no groundwater conservation district, so they can just do whatever they want there. So we got an oil and gas boom that's going. We're producing lots of oil and gas in southern New Mexico. They're wanting permits for frack water. And the state of New Mexico starts denying permits. right? The state says, we're not going to issue a permit for you to pump water to frack your wells in New Mexico. And so what do the oil companies come up with to get around New Mexico not issuing a permit? They just go hop the border, right? Right across the state line we go into Texas, into a county where who has the right to pump that groundwater? Any landowner, right? And so the oil and gas company shows up with some cash and gets an agreement from the landowner to lease or buy their groundwater, and they basically run a hose across the state line. Let me see if I can find a picture. So here's a map of where this is occurring, right? Loving County is here. Here's Lee County. Okay, and it's on this one ranch road. There's more than one, but this is the example that was used in this article that I pulled this all out of. Here's the hose. Okay, they literally went across the border, pump groundwater, run a hose across, and bam, we're producing oil and gas. Now, if you're the government in New Mexico, are you happy about this? No, right? Because what's the problem? Who doesn't know there's a state line there? The water, right? And so New Mexico's saying, no, we don't have enough water for you to be pumping to frack. And they're like, no sweat, we'll go to Texas, and then we'll run it back over. It's the same water, right? And so it's a big deal. And so I think it was probably 2 years ago now, the then New Mexico land commissioner named Aubrey Dunn made a big stink about this in the paper and said, like, hey, Texas is stealing New Mexico's water. This is a problem. We need to do something, et cetera. Various administration changes have happened. There have been no lawsuits filed, at least at this point. But I think this is a fascinating issue, right? Because you look at it, and you've got Texas law, which is not being violated, right? They have every right to pump that groundwater. And you've got New Mexico law, which is not being violated, because they said they couldn't get a permit, and they're not pumping water in New Mexico. But when they're right next to each other and it's the same aquifer, how are we going to deal with two sovereign states with two different legal approaches as we go forward? Right? And where is the perfect storm to see this issue? The Ogallala Aquifer. Right? Because we got lots of states involved. Okay? So there's a picture of the Ogallala Aquifer. Here is the different types of groundwater law that each state is governed by. South Dakota uses prior appropriation, so they take the New Mexico approach, right? You got to get a permit. Nebraska sort of has an interesting combination of reasonable use and correlative rights. Just very basic here, okay? Reasonable use essentially means you have a right to reasonably use the water beneath your property. It has to be used on that property. Victoria, is that right or am I backwards? I'm doubting myself now. Reasonable use has to be used on that property, and we don't really care how your reasonable use affects your neighbor. If it's reasonable for what you're doing, it's okay. Correlative rights is similar. It basically says you kind of have the right to like use your reasonable share of the water, but under correlative rights, it can be used off the property, and we do care how your use affects your neighbor. Right? So maybe it's not reasonable if I'm using too much and it's impacting my neighbor. So completely different scheme, right? Wyoming, Colorado, and Kansas are all prior appropriation. Oklahoma is reasonable use or correlative rights, and that's based on some grandfathering that's happened, and there's different rules for domestic wells there. Prior appropriation in New Mexico, and then, of course, our rule of capture here in Texas. I don't know what the answer is. Right? I'm not sure how this plays out. Maybe we're going to end up with some sort of like interstate agreements, right? Compacts or something. We've seen a lot of those with respect to surface water around the United States. Unfortunately, we've also seen a lot of lawsuits about those related to surface water around the United States, including one involving Texas and New Mexico and the Rio Grande. Anybody familiar with that case? Super interesting issue that's not completely foreign to this, right? But in that case, there's a compact that governs how much water we share from the Rio Grande between Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas. And what the compact says is that New Mexico has to deliver a certain amount of surface water in the Rio Grande to Texas at the Elephant Butte Reservoir, which is maybe 100 miles or so north of the New Mexico-Texas border. Okay? And so New Mexico does it. They follow the compact. They deliver their water at Elephant Butte. But then, right, the water's got to travel 100 miles down the river to get to Texas, and New Mexico issues a whole bunch of groundwater production permits right next to the river. And so all the New Mexico landowners, legally, because they have the permits, are pumping groundwater right next to the river. Well, what do you think that's doing to the water in the river? Right? And so when it gets to Texas, Texas says, we're not getting the water that we're owed. New Mexico says, hey, man, we complied with the compact. We did exactly what it says. You can't tell us how to manage our permitting process in our state. Ooh, sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? So, super interesting issue. That case is also currently at the United States Supreme Court. There's a special master that's been appointed. I think the overall takeaway point here is I think we're going to just see more and more disputes between states, especially states that have differing legal schemes when it's related to water. Okay, the next case I want to talk about is the Strata case. And this is really interesting. So here's what happens in this case down in Bryan. So they're in the Brazos County Groundwater Conservation District, and the Brazos County District uses this formula. We're not going to use that at all. No one panic. I don't do math. That's why I went to law school. Okay? But they use this formula to basically figure out how many acres you have is going to control how much water you get the permit to pump. The idea here behind this, right, just real generally is, look, if somebody owns 1 acre, they own the groundwater, right? We know that. If somebody owns 10,000 acres, they own the groundwater. But should they both be allowed to produce the same amount of groundwater? That's really the question, right? Should your amount you can produce depend on the size of the tract of land that you have? So they, in their permitting process, when deciding how much water you can pump, came up with this formula, and you put in the production rate times some spacing requirements. That's pi. I don't know what that's for. And they give you the number of acres you have to produce a certain amount of water. And that's how they award permits in that district. Well, the city of Bryan owns 2.7 acres of land, okay, next to a guy named Mr. Fazzino. They were granted a permit, the city was granted a permit to drill a well 3,000 foot from the property line to pump 300,000 gallons per minute and 4,800 acre feet per year. So that's the permit that gets given to the city on their 2.7 acres. That does not follow the formula. Okay? That's way more than the formula would have given them. Had they followed the formula, they would have been able to pump 192 gallons per minute, right, versus 3,000, and they could have had 315 acre feet versus 4,800. Okay? Well, Mr. Fazzino's next door, and he's not thrilled when he finds out about this, and he owns 26 acres of land. And so Mr. Fazzino goes and asks for the exact same permit that the city of Bryan got, word for word, asks for the same thing. And the Groundwater Conservation District said, no, we're not going to issue that. We're going to follow our formula, and you get 192 gallons per minute, and you get 315 acre feet a year. And Mr. Fazzino says, hey, wait a minute, that's not right, because you did something different for the city. And in the rules, there's no distinction between landowner versus city or municipality or anything like that. So this case currently right now it's at the Fifth Circuit. Mr. Fazzino filed a lawsuit, and he claimed a taking, right, so that the government has taken his private property rights, and he's owed just compensation because they didn't follow their formula. He also claims a violation of equal protection. In other words, we have two people who are similarly situated under the law, and the district's treating them differently. I think that's really an interesting question. This case right now, like I say, it's at the Fifth Circuit. On appeal, it's a little bit interesting to me. They're fighting over like sovereign immunity stuff. They haven't really got to the basics of the case. But I think it raises a broader question, right? Is there some sort of limitation or some sort of difference in the amount of water we're allowed to produce based on the size of the tract of land that we have? Should there be? And how does that play out at the different groundwater conservation districts across Texas. So I think an interesting case to keep an eye on. Again, right now they're bickering over some sovereign immunity and like technical legal issues at the Fifth Circuit. I assume it's probably going to come back down to the trial court at some point and potentially proceed. But a really interesting case to be aware of. Okay, one more case that I'll mention related to Texas law. It's not new. It's actually old. But it involves the city of Lubbock, and I think it's a really important case to be aware of. And it's still pending as far as I know. In this case, it's called the Coyote Lake Ranch versus the city of Lubbock. Okay, you probably have heard of it. But what happened there is the Coyote Lake Ranch had a bunch of water rights on its ranch out around Muleshoe. And in the 50s, they sold those groundwater rights to the city of Lubbock. Okay, so the city buys the rights. There's a deed that's signed that gets deeded over to the city. They have rights to come on and drill wells, etc. At that time, I think they drilled a small number of wells, maybe like 4 or 5 wells or something for groundwater. Not a big deal. Okay. In the years that followed, the ranch changes hands. So we have a new surface owner who bought the ranch without groundwater rights. He knew, right, because it was in the deed. But he didn't get paid because it had already been sold to the other landowner. Okay. So about 2014, the city of Lubbock comes knocking on the door and says, hey, we're here to drill our water wells so we can produce that groundwater that we own. We're going to put in like 60 wells kind of all over your ranch, like all over the middle of the ranch. And if I'm the surface owner, I'm not thrilled, right? I don't get any money from this, and you're about to come out and like cause me all this headache and hassle. So he goes to his lawyer and basically says, come up with something. Find me a legal theory. We know we can't stop them from drilling the wells, but we need to have some sort of say in like where they are and how this is done. So the legal theory the lawyer comes up with is something from oil and gas law called the accommodation doctrine. The accommodation doctrine basically says that if you are an oil and gas company, you have the dominant right, okay, over the surface owner, which means, okay, you have the right to go drill your well, but you have to try to accommodate an existing surface use if certain requirements are met. This has never been applied outside of oil and gas. And so the trial court judge issued an injunction and says, okay, everybody hold up. Nobody's drilling a well till we sort this out. Then it goes on appeal to the Amarillo Court of Appeals, and the judges there say, okay, listen, the courts have never applied the accommodation doctrine outside of oil and gas. We're not going to do it, but if you want to go ask the Supreme Court, feel free. We're just not doing something they've never done. So Coyote Lake Ranch took that invitation, right? The city of Lubbock takes that invitation, goes to the Texas Supreme Court, and wins. And so in this case that came out in 2016, which is a huge deal, it had decided two things. The first thing it decided is that the accommodation doctrine can apply to severed groundwater. And we'll talk in a minute about how that would work. The second thing that it decided was that a severed groundwater right is a dominant estate, just like a severed oil and gas right. That's a big deal, because what that means now is if you've got groundwater that is severed, the groundwater owner has this automatic implied right to use as much of the surface as is reasonably necessary to produce the groundwater. That had never been stated before by the Texas Supreme Court. And so I think that's a really big deal to be aware of. So after it goes to the Supreme Court, right, the court said that the accommodation doctrine can apply to groundwater. And so the case goes back then to the trial court for the trial court to decide, does the accommodation doctrine apply in this case under these facts? Essentially, we know it can, but does it under the facts we have here? And so the court says, they're still at the court now, at the trial court. Here's the test the court's going to apply. For the accommodation doctrine to apply, and what the Coyote Lake Ranch wants essentially is they want the wells drilled kind of on the outside of the property. They don't want a bunch of overhead power lines. They want some say in like where things are done. They will get that under the accommodation doctrine if they can prove three things. The first thing is they have to show that the groundwater could be produced another way. Okay. The second thing they have to show is that the the groundwater could be produced another way. The second thing is, let me think. That's why I should have slides. Yes, as a substantial, thank you, a substantial impact on the existing use of the property. So there has to be some existing use now, and they have to show that that existing use could not be made in another way. So let's think about it. Do we think that these 60 wells scattered out all over the ranch is going to have a substantial impact on an existing use? Probably, right? Do we think that you can produce groundwater another way? Probably they can have their wells and you have directional drilling and those sorts of things and still drill them from the outside of the property. That's going to be an issue. And then the other question is, can the ranch still be a ranch and run cattle even if we have these wells everywhere? That's the one that's usually sticky in the court cases. And so we'll have to see what the court does on that. I think, again, interesting case, something to be aware of. We still don't know how that applies to the facts here, but that Supreme Court case really did change, I think, Texas groundwater law. Okay, the last case I want to talk about, we're going to go to the federal level. So not Texas level, but United States level issue. And it's referred to as groundwater as a conduit. Okay, Federal Clean Water Act, right? Federal statute that tries to basically protect our waters from pollution, et cetera. Okay, and it applies to waters of the United States. That's that definition that's been released new today. Okay, essentially what that act says is if you you have to get a federal permit if you're going to make a point source discharge of a pollutant into a water of the United States. So for example, if you've got like a factory and you're going to take a pipe and put pollutants out into the river, you got to get a federal permit to have the right to do that. That's the cleanest example of how that would work. All right, so a question has come up. That discharge, right, where that pipe dumps into that river, does it have to be a direct discharge from the pipe into the river, or could it be an indirect discharge that uses groundwater as a conduit? Here's the facts in a couple of cases. There have been a number of cases around the country that have reached different results. We'll talk about those. The Supreme Court heard argument in a case called Maui versus the Hawaii Wildlife Fund. They heard argument in that case in November. It was awesome because I actually was in D.C. with my research associate. Austin Vincent is here. He's a third-year law student at Texas Tech. He does research for me, and we both happened to be in D.C., and we got to go listen to the argument at the court, which was awesome if you're a nerdy lawyer. If you're a not nerdy lawyer, I don't know that that's where you want to go in D.C. We thought it was super cool to do, all right? And here's the facts of the case. So let's talk about Maui County. What they have there is the county of Maui has a disposal well where they inject the effluent water from Maui into the groundwater. And they do this a short distance from the Pacific Ocean. And guess where the water ends up? In the Pacific Ocean, right? They did a dye test. They can prove that, no problem. And so this Hawaii Wildlife Fund's an environmental group that came out and said, hey, we think you have to get a federal permit to do that because you are discharging a pollutant from a point source into the Pacific Ocean, which is a water of the United States. And the response from Maui was, no, we don't have to have a permit. Our pipe doesn't go into the ocean, right? Our pipe goes into the groundwater, and groundwater is not covered by the Clean Water Act. It has to be a direct discharge. Okay, so the Ninth Circuit sides with the Hawaii Wildlife Fund and says, yeah, they had to get a permit, right? They say this basically thing is if it's reasonably traceable from the input, right here from the injection well to the Pacific Ocean, if you can reasonably trace it, they've got to get this federal permit. Now, understand why we care about this. This federal permit is no joke. Okay? It's not like you run down and they stamp it. On average, for a simple permit, it takes a year to get it, and it takes $30,000. Okay? So if this is a deal, this is a big deal to Maui. Okay? So at the Supreme Court, it was really interesting, and the justices seemed to kind of struggle in that they, I don't think they really love the argument of either side. Okay? So what happens is the Hawaii, or the Maui County folks stand up, right? The lawyers for Maui, and they basically make a hard line rule, and they say, the rule should be, if it goes into groundwater, we don't care where it ends up. Right? That's not the test. It has to be a direct discharge into the water of the United States. That's not groundwater. No permit. On the one side, the justices probably like that because it is a very bright line rule, right? We know yes or no on anything you give us. The problem, I think, for them was this idea of what's to stop everybody then from just skirting around, right? Doing an end run around the Clean Water Act, and everybody makes their pipe, instead of going into the ocean, they put it into the water this far from the ocean. And now nobody ever has to get a permit, right? So they didn't love that test, I don't think. Well, then Hawaii gets up and they use this, they basically say it has to be fairly traceable, right? So you have to get a permit if your discharge into the groundwater is fairly traceable from the water of the United States. They probably didn't love that because it's a little bit mushy, right? What is fairly traceable and what's not? Who do you think is going to spend a lot of time and make a lot of money arguing about that? The lawyers, right? But the court's like, well, that's not a very bright line rule. I don't know. This isn't, you know, they kind of go back and forth. And the big concern that I thought was really interesting is they were really worried about people with septic tanks. Because they said, hey, if this is the rule, right? And I think it was Chief Justice Roberts who said, listen, I read some of the briefs from the scientists. Those guys can trace anything from anywhere. What if they can get into the Pacific Ocean and pinpoint the exact toilet or septic tank that that came out of? Does that septic tank owner then have to have a federal permit to have a septic tank? And how many people in America have septic tanks? Where is this going to end, basically? So that was the oral argument. We don't know what the court's going to do. The guess of most lawyers that I talk to is they're going to come up with something in the middle. Maybe they'll come up with their own test. Maybe they're going to word something differently. We don't know. We'll know in June when they come up with their decision. But I think that this is a really fascinating issue. There have been a couple other cases. So the County of Maui is the one that was at the Supreme Court with the pipe, with the injection well. We've seen this also in the coal ash pond context. So when you produce coal, they end up and they put the coal ash in these big ponds. And some of the minerals or whatever seep into the groundwater from the ponds and then end up in a river down the road. And so courts in Kentucky and then the Sixth Circuit have said the argument there was maybe they needed a permit for that. The coal ash ponds needed a permit. Courts in the Sixth Circuit and in Kentucky have said no. No permit required for that. One of them said it's not a point source, right? It's not like a pipe, it's a pond. The other one just said it's got to be a direct discharge. Okay, we also had a case out of the Fourth Circuit. This happened in Virginia or West Virginia, where there was a pipeline. So there was an oil pipeline, right, underground, and there was a rupture in the pipeline, and oil leaked and went through the groundwater to a lake nearby. Environmental group sues and says, hey, you should have had a NEPEDES permit for your pipeline. That one's a little bit harder of a sell for me because they didn't know the pipeline was going to rupture, right? So they should have gotten a permit in case it ruptured. Is that going to impose a test on every pipeline company? I don't know, right? In the Fourth Circuit there, the company said it was sufficiently connected to navigable water, and they said, yes, the pipeline company should have had a permit. Okay? So I do think this has the ability to impact agriculture. That's why I brought it up. Two things that I want to say. Number one, let's think about the potential of us to have some sort of substance leach into the groundwater and end up in a lake or a river or a stream. What about our lagoons? Strikes me that could sure happen, right? We could get something to leach out of those. What about fertilizer? Right? What about our septic tanks? I think depending on how broadly this is defined, there is a potential issue there. The other issue I want to bring up for agriculture that's broader than this context is if you look at the plaintiffs, right, the people bringing the lawsuit in every one of these cases, it's not the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the agency that governs this. Who is it that brings the lawsuits? It's these activist environmental type groups, right? The Hawaii Wildlife Fund. I think River Water Keepers brought one. Upstate Forever is another environmental group. What I'm telling you is, if you look at a lot of the cases where agriculture is defendants, a lot of them are dealing with citizen suits brought by these different environmental or activist type groups. And you see this across the board, not just related to water, but I think that's something that we better be aware of, because I think that we're going to see more and more of that. And I've heard some people actually call that legislation through the judiciary, right? Maybe they've got things passed that they wanted in the legislature. They couldn't get some bill through. So another way to get effects is to go to court and file these lawsuits. And so I think there's something to be aware of. It's a trend I certainly think that we're seeing. Okay, the last thing I'll say, and then I've tried to leave a few minutes for questions, is I've got some resources on agricultural law and water law, if you all are interested in those. The first one is, I've got a website. It's called the Texas Agriculture Law Blog. If you Google that, you can find it, or you can go to that website there. Anything I do gets posted there. So any updates on cases, anything like that, handbooks, fact sheets, checklists, they all go right there. When you go to that website, it will pop up a little box, and it'll ask you to put your email address in. If you'll do that and hit subscribe, my post will come to you just like an email from me. That way you don't have to remember to go check the website every time. The other thing I'll tell you is there's a little tab here called Published Materials right there. I've done several handbooks and fact sheets that might be helpful. You can download all of those there for free. One of them, the most recent one that I've done, is this here. It's a handbook called Owning Your Piece of Texas. And it basically is just a guide for Texas landowners on like the top 14 or 15 laws they ought to be aware of. And you have a brief overview, of course, water laws in there. You know, everything from landowner liability to fence law to property taxes, all sorts of different things. And again, that's available. It's a free download on the website. If you want a hard copy, we have to charge for those, but you can contact me and I'll be glad to help you get set up for that. I do have a handful of other programs coming up. You can find those on my website. We won't go through all of those today. And then the last thing I'll mention is I have a podcast called Ag Law in the Field. If you are a podcast listener, you can listen on iTunes or your podcast app. We're on Stitcher, Google Play. If none of that made any sense to you, don't panic. You can listen on your computer. You just go to that website right there. Type in aglaw.libsyn.com. What you'll find is a list of 70 episodes where I interview an ag lawyer on a different topic. All you have to do is push play on whatever topic that you want, and you'll hear just an audio interview. I mentioned I've got the one with Victoria on groundwater conservation districts. I've got a couple with Austin. One of those is recapping the Supreme Court. There's about 70 to choose from, and they're free to listen to, so feel free to check that out as well. The last slide here has all of my contact information. If you all need information after this, if I can be helpful on anything, please feel free to contact me. I'm sure glad to help however I can. So with that, I will be glad to take any questions that we have. Yes, sir. His question is, on a river where there's a sandbar or an island, who owns the island? I'm going to say this and tell you, I think that this would be the general answer. There could be some exception I don't know of. And generally, it's probably going to depend on if that's a navigable stream. If it is, generally, the state owns the stream bed of a navigable stream. So I think there would have to be something to undo that, but my guess is it's owned by the state if it's a navigable stream under those two definitions that we looked at. But yeah, so it would be open to the public, and so then you would have the right to use it if it's state-owned stream bed. Now, again, don't go, like, pitch a tent somewhere and call me from jail, okay? But in general, that's how that works. The state owns the stream beds of navigable streams, and if the island or sandbar is in the stream bed, that should be the answer. Now, if it's outside of the stream bed, it would be owned by the landowner of that property. Any other questions? Yes, Bobby. Yes. at least it, so his question is that strata case where that groundwater conservation district had that formula, could that apply like to an ag landowner? Let's say I've got a section of land, could they use that formula and then tell me how much I could pump? Yes. And in fact, that's what they do in that case. And they look not only at how many acres, but they look at, you know, the amount of water you're wanting to pump. Then they do that crazy formula. But that's the formula that they use to decide how much water you can get for your permit. And now that's that specific district. Remember, there's 100 districts, 100 different rules. High Plains doesn't use that rule, for example. But that's an example of a rule that a district does have. Okay. Thank you guys very much.